From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Dwindling from the divisional before the change to championship, the baseball playoff series roll on. Ahead on Only a Game, how the Great Eight will winnow to the Fall Four. Also, the life of wholesome hurler Christy Mathewson, and an audio fantasy depicting the likely result of a Chicago Cubs-Boston Red Sox World Series. Also ahead on Only a Game, Native American iron workers gird for greater girder glory.
I ain't afraid of heights. You can put me in, no matter how high you want me, I'll go. 1,000 feet, 2,000, 3,000, I'll go. It doesn't bother me one bit.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Military officials in Iraq say a U.S. patrol came under attack in Baghdad today. They say one soldier was killed and a second was injured. Elsewhere in Baghdad today, U.S. forces fired shots into the air to disperse a protest. Hundreds of former Iraqi soldiers were demonstrating to demand back pay and jobs. Some threw rocks and a car was set on fire. Witnesses say that several Iraqis were wounded. Critics of the war in Iraq are citing a report released this week by Weapons Inspector David Kaye. He told Congress that so far he has not found any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Kaye was back on Capitol Hill yesterday. He criticized the way that his report has been portrayed. NPR's David Wellner reports.
After meeting behind closed doors with the Senate Armed Services Committee, Kaye complained how a report he released Thursday is played in the news.
This is an interim report. We've been at work only 3 months. Under extraordinarily difficult conditions to work in. We are closing no files, reaching no final conclusions. We have, and as you know, you would have been probably the first to know, found no actual weapons at this point.
Kaye said he may still find those weapons, but Senator Ted Kennedy, a Massachusetts Democrat who met with Kaye, was skeptical.
All I can say is I didn't believe there was an imminent threat to the United States when we went to war, and I'm more convinced than ever, listening to him, that there never was a threat either.
Kennedy said money for hunting weapons in Iraq would be better spent searching for Osama bin Laden. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
NASA says it probably will not be ready to launch a space shuttle again for nearly another year. The space agency is making inspections and modifications following the Columbia accident. Officials say the process is taking longer than they expected. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
NASA had hoped a space shuttle might fly again sometime next March, but officials say there is simply too much to do. Bill Reedy, the Associate Administrator for Spaceflight, told reporters that engineers were still redesigning the fuel tank. During the Columbia flight, a piece of foam from the fuel tank broke loose and fatally damaged the shuttle's wing. Engineers are also busy building an extension for the shuttle arm so it can survey the entire shuttle for damage while it is in orbit. Repair kits are also being prepared so astronauts can patch holes in the shuttle if necessary. The new target window for launch is September 12th through October 10th, 2004. Reedy told reporters that getting the next shuttle in shape would be, quote, a long uphill climb. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Storm warnings are in effect along most of Mexico's Gulf Coast as Tropical Storm Larry approaches. Residents are being told to be prepared for high tides, floods, and heavy rains starting today. Hurricane Nora is hovering far south of Mexico's Baja California Peninsula. It's expected to move north but stay well out to sea. This is NPR News. Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo says she will run in presidential elections next May. Last year, she had said that she would not be a candidate. The BBC's John McClain reports from Manila.
President Gloria Arroyo told a huge outdoor gathering, which resembled an election rally, that she would defer her retirement. This meant that she changed her mind and had decided to seek a full 6-year term as president in elections next May. Mrs. Arroyo took office in 2001 when a peaceful popular uprising overthrew President Joseph Estrada, who'd been accused of corruption. She said then that hers would be a reforming government. But since then, it's lurched from one crisis to another, and problems such as corruption, crime, terrorism, communist and Muslim separatist rebellions, and especially poverty, remain virulent.
The BBC's John McClain reporting from Manila. The Roy of Siegfried and Roy was attacked by a tiger on stage at the Mirage Hotel Casino last night. Roy Horn was alone with the tiger about halfway through the act when the tiger lunged at him. At first, audience members Sharna Wiblin and Tawny Dobson didn't realize anything was wrong.
When we were sitting there in the audience, we honestly thought that it was part of the show. We didn't know what was going on.
Probably wasn't until he got the microphone and started tapping him on the snout, that sort of thing, that people sort of started to get a bit shocked. At that point, people started getting a bit worried because being close to the stage, you could hear that the people on stage weren't really playing. They were for real, the way they were talking.
Hospital officials say Roy Horn is in critical but stable condition after several hours of surgery. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In Miami last night, Marlins catcher Pudge Rodriguez knocked home two runs with an 11th-inning single, leading the Florida Marlins to a 4-3 win over the San Francisco Giants in Game 3 of their National League Divisional Series. The Marlins leading the series 2-1, host Game 4 this afternoon. In Chicago, the Cubs rode the superior pitching of Mark Pryor to a 3-1 win over the Atlanta Braves. Down 2-1 in that division playoff series, the Braves must win this afternoon to prolong their season. In the American League divisional contests, the Red Sox, down 2-0, host Oakland tonight. The Yankees and Twins, tied at 1-1, meet this afternoon in Minneapolis. Thursday night's quarterfinal World Cup doubleheader in Foxborough, Massachusetts, began with a show of considerable enthusiasm from some of the fans clad in Brazil's colors and wrapped in its flag as they tried to inspire the young but very talented Brazilian team. The team's response was a little disappointing. Brazil fell behind the more experienced and more organized team from Sweden in the 23rd minute when Victoria Svensson scored. But the energy of the young men cheering for Brazil inspired a group of young women from Quincy, Massachusetts, wearing high school soccer jackets to join the chanting.
We just decided to pick a team to cheer for in Brazil.
The Brazil fans are very energetic.
Brazil is definitely the team that's going to win.
Brazil is where it's at right now.
Brazil versus USA.
It's all about Brazil right now. That's where it's at.
Brazil.
Go Brazil!
Ultimately, Brazil, which had surprised Norway 4-1 in the first round of the tournament, could not cope with the physical play of the Swedes, who won the game 2-1 on a penalty kick in the 53rd minute. Outside the locker room after the game, Victoria Svensson, who'd scored Sweden's first goal, was asked if she cared which team Sweden would have to play in the semifinals on Sunday.
If you want to have the gold medal, you have to win against everyone, so it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter who you play next or who you play in the final. You just
we're gonna try to win everything. So
though the size of the crowd watching the match between Sweden and Brazil was disappointing by 1999 World Cup standards, by the time the game ended, over 25,000 people had arrived at Gillette Stadium for the evening's main event.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's once again welcome the national teams of USA.
Once again is an understatement. The U.S. and Norway have been playing against each other for 16 years, thereby establishing the most significant rivalry in the women's game. The U.S. has won two World Cups, Norway won the other. Each team has won an Olympic gold medal. Together they have pushed the women's game to improve. Games between the U.S. and Norway have become increasingly more physical over the years, so it was no surprise when the first goal in Wednesday night's game came when one of the most physical players on the pitch muscled her way through Norway's defense to get her head on a long Kat Reddick pass. Abby Wambach's third goal of the tournament was, as it turned out, all the U.S. team would need. showcasing not only Wombat's dominance on attack, but a nearly impenetrable defense anchored by Joy Fawcett and Kate Sobrero. The U.S. had a 60% to 40% edge in possession throughout the match and limited the Norwegian team to a single shot on goal. Only an outstanding performance by Norway keeper Bente Norby kept the score close. Norby appropriately was named player of the match, but in a press conference afterward, Norway coach Steen Aga acknowledged the obvious.
Bente is a really good goalkeeper, maybe the best goalkeeper in the world, but that wasn't enough today to win the match.
U.S. coach April Heinrich's next step to the podium, after praising her defense for its tenacity and Abby Wambach for not only playing the best game of her career, but for staying controlled through a night of bumping, blocking, and flying elbows both incoming and outgoing. The U.S. coach, whose team has played games in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Columbus, Ohio, and Foxborough, Massachusetts, on the way to Oregon and then California, expressed relief.
We're just thankful that we got through the quarterfinal rounds. I thought that this is one of the more difficult periods for our team, playing two games back-to-back with just 2 days rest and having to be the team that travels. And Norway had 3 days rest. We had 2 days rest. So this was a critical night for us.
Now the satisfaction of beating Norway is history. Tomorrow, in one World Cup semifinal in Portland, the U.S. will play Germany, winners in Thursday night's quarterfinal match against Russia. In the other semifinal, Sweden will face China, 2-1 victors over Russia in their Thursday match. The National Hockey League's 2003 regular season begins on Wednesday, but the uncertainty regarding the 2004 season and beyond is currently tainting what would ordinarily be the most festive of seasons for fans of pro hockey. So we once again call upon the L.A. Times cross-check chronicler Helene Elliott, who often doubles as only a game's winsome wizard of the winter game. Welcome back, Helene.
Why, thank you. I was so looking forward to hearing the new titles you had for me this season.
It's a challenge to come up with new ones each time.
But you have not disappointed.
Well, Wednesday marked the first meeting between the NHL players and owners in their attempt to work out a new labor agreement before the September 15, 2004 deadline. Though the meeting was characterized as, quote, positive, the NHL nevertheless rejected a proposal by the players, which I gather was a revenue-sharing model similar to the one in place in Major League Baseball. Does the league wish to implement a salary cap model a la the NFL?
Exactly. I spoke to Bob Goodenow, who's the head of the Players Union, and he said that the NHL owners and NHL people were not interested in discussing anything except an NFL-style hard cap.
Mm-hmm.
And owners are going to apparently be very insistent upon it. During the last negotiations in 1994-95, that was what they went in looking for, and they came out with much less. They came out with a salary cap for the first 3 years of a player's pro career, but general managers and agents and everybody very quickly found ways to get around it by including these huge bonus clauses, and that really just threw everybody's budgets out of whack. But they're resolute this time that they're not going to accept anything short of a salary cap.
Well, let's get right to the specifics of the allegations of revenue. The NHL claimed this week that it lost $1.5 billion over the last 9 years, the term of the current collective bargaining agreement. Is there any way to confirm that figure, or do we just have to take their word for it or dismiss it as standard poor mouthing?
Well, you know, last season the Kings opened up their books to me, and I had a few hours to look through things. They brought in an accountant. And when you look at some of the numbers and you use common sense, you have to say, yeah, I can see where they don't have a whole lot of money coming in terms of comparing it to the NFL. I mean, the NHL TV revenues are a pittance compared to the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NBA. And player salaries have gone up. I mean, the average NHL player salary last season was just under $1.8 million, and the average NFL player salary was much lower.
Mm.
But each NFL team got something like $77 million in TV money, and that's just national TV money, not local TV money. NHL teams got something like $5 million each in national TV money. But nobody ever opens their books completely. You're not going to see all the arena revenues. You're not going to see the parking. You're not going to see some of the concession stuff that they get because they put it all into separate corporations. And it's kind of like, you know, well, you're taking it out of your left pocket and putting it into your right. So you can say, well, I'm broke. I have no money in my left pocket.
Well, you are making it sound, however, as if Bob Goodenow, the head of the NHL Players Association, is misrepresenting the case when he says the current system is a good one and it's poor business decisions by several NHL teams that are to blame for the financial woes plaguing the league.
Well, you know, actually, he's right in some respects. I mean, nobody put a gun to the New York Rangers' heads and told them that they had to pay Bobby Holik the amount of money that they paid him and Darius Kasparaitis the amount of money that they paid him. The players are saying, well, some of these owners made mistakes, but why should we pay for their mistakes? If they can't stick to a budget like the Minnesota Wild did last season in doing so well, like the Anaheim Mighty Ducks did last season, like teams in Vancouver and other places do, stick to a budget, build within, you know, develop players through drafting and their minor league system. You know, if teams can't show that kind of fiscal restraint, why should we be made to pay for it?
All right, Helene, one last question, or actually a two-part question. One, does this season become more important than any other because we may be looking at no season at all after it, given all the labor management problems? And two, who wins?
I think you're going to see in January and February and early March when teams realize that they're out of it, I think you're going to see a lot of teams dump a lot of high-priced players because they don't want to have to pay those players next season if there isn't any season. I think it's going to affect a lot of teams who are going to say, look, we better go for it this year because there may not be a next year. As far as who wins it, if I could tell you that, I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be in Tahiti with a winning lottery ticket in my hand or the proceeds from one anyway.
Well, all we ever ask for is your best shot.
You know, you got to look at New Jersey and realize how well adapted they are to the playoff style of hockey. You know, the tight defense and Martin Brodeur in goal, and you have to like them. And I think Ottawa, they learned a lot last season by losing in the playoffs. They had a great regular season. I think now they realize what it really takes to make that next step up. I'm curious to see how they'll do this season. And, you know, you look in the West, I think the Ducks are arguably better this season. Colorado is going to be exciting to watch one way or another. And Detroit and Dallas also.
Helene Elliott is the L.A. Times Ice Queen and siren of the skate sharpener for Only a Game. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
But we all know, and you Sabre fans know, that that was not a goal.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. It is said that when the armies of Lancaster and the armies of York ran out of ammunition during the 15th century, determined soldiers would throw food at one another, thus qualifying the War of the Roses as one of history's 10 messiest civil wars. In homage to the determination of the worthies serving the houses of Lancaster and York in those bygone days, Englishmen and assorted others gathered at the Royal Oak Pub in the village of Ramsbottom, Lancashire, to compete in the World Black Pudding Throwing Championship on Sunday. Combatants hurl the sausage-like construction of cooked pig's blood, fat, and rusk at a stationary Yorkshire pudding, attempting to dislodge it. One presumes the losers have to clean up and perhaps stay for lunch.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL preseason action, the Washington Capitals edged the Carolina Hurricanes by a score of 3-2. The St. Louis Blues defeated the Columbus Blue Jackets by the same score, and the Montreal Canadiens and Minnesota Wild decided that was a nice tally, and so the Habs roofed three biscuits and the Wild just two. Elsewhere, the New York Rangers blanked the New Jersey Devils 2-0. The Atlanta Thrashers thumped the Predators of Nashville 5-2. And the Los Angeles Kings crowned the Anaheim Mighty Ducks 4-0. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a vision of Armageddon on the baseball diamond. But first, following the 1912 World Series, which the New York Giants lost to the Boston Red Sox, an editorial in one of the New York papers said of Giants pitcher Christy Mathewson, "In victory, he was admirable, but in defeat, he was magnificent." That's part of what intrigued Philip Seeb about one of the greatest pitchers who ever lived, and part of the reason Mr. Seeb has written The Player, subtitled Christy Mathewson, Baseball and the American Century. Philip Seeb joins me now from WUWM in Milwaukee. Mr. Seeb, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be with you.
To establish a context, Christy Mathewson didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to show how magnificent he was in defeat. He won 373 games for the Giants over the course of his 17-year career, posting earned run averages such as 1.14 and 1.27. Who was ever better?
Well, I think you can make the argument that he was the greatest pitcher of all time. I'm sure Walter Johnson and Cy Young and more recent pitchers like Bob Gibson and Sandy Koufax have their partisans. But he really was remarkable, particularly in what he called pitching in the pinch. When runners were on base, he was at his best. And he also did something that players today don't often do. He relied on his teammates. He once threw a complete game 67 pitches.
And that is a statistic which is perhaps the most stunning in the entire book. We've got guys who throw 67 pitches an inning now.
Well, that's right. That's right. And when he pitched in the 1905 World Series, he pitched three games in 6 days, all complete games, all shutouts, walked one over the whole three games, and that propelled the Giants to a stunning upset victory over the Philadelphia Athletics in that series.
You maintain that Christy Mathewson was baseball's first superstar. I wonder who it was who first provided that designation, and what did that status constitute back in 1903?
Well, when Mathewson came into professional baseball was sort of like wrestling is today. It was considered a kind of a low-life sport. A lot of the players were gamblers and drunk a lot of the time. In fact, a lot of first-rate hotels and many second-rate hotels wouldn't let major league teams stay there because the players misbehaved so much. And that kept fans away, too. It attracted a certain level of fans, but the middle and upper classes, they'd go to college games or to local amateur games, but they wouldn't come to Major League Baseball. And Mathewson, by his example, really legitimized baseball in the eyes of this new fan base. He was a college man. He had gone to Bucknell College, and was very famous as a football player. He was a drop kicker for Bucknell. He was very moral. He would never pitch on Sundays. That was a promise he had made to his mother, who wanted him to become a preacher instead of a ball player. And he didn't throw up batters. He didn't fight with umpires. He didn't get in brawls with other teams. Very different from the kind of baseball that was being played at that time. And he really became a paragon of what Theodore Roosevelt was talking about at that time, the strenuous life, which was a mix of physical excellence and mental sharpness and morality as well.
Regarding some of his teammates and opponents as well, you've got one anecdote that really pins them down, I think, rather dramatically. You say they were drunks, bullies, and thugs, guys who would nail their steaks to the restaurant wall if the meat was tough. How did Christy Mathewson, gentleman that he was, get along with these guys?
Well, he got along pretty well with most of them. For one thing, when his teammates ever let him down with an error or something like that, He never criticized them. In fact, at times when some heartbreaking losses occurred, such as that 1912 series you mentioned, he tried to cheer up his teammates, even ones who'd committed the errors, saying, you know, it's not up to me to be hard on them. So he really was a team player. There were a few players who thought he was too high and mighty, but for the most part, he was so good at what he did and so fair-minded and never patronizing to his teammates that he generally had quite a strong following amongst those he played with.
In your research for this book, were you able to find anybody or learn of anybody who had a bad word to say about Christy Mathewson?
Well, certainly Hal Chase, who was the notorious baseball player slash gambler, didn't like Mathewson much because Mathewson basically ran him out of the game. And there were a few teammates, usually people who were with the New York Giants very briefly, who might have a few critical words. But people like his catcher, Chief Myers, said, you know, we love to play with him. So he really was a good guy.
One of my favorite moments in your book involves Mathewson's wife, Jane. From their apartment, she could see the scoreboard in the polo grounds where the Giants played, and she once said, quote, "As soon as the game reached the seventh inning, I knew it was time to put on my potatoes." For several reasons, that would be a risky supposition about a game today. For one thing, games didn't take as long then as they do now.
Oh, that's right. They would be over in an hour and a half sometimes. And if she knew that Christy was pitching, she was pretty sure that it would get wrapped up.
She was also pretty sure that he'd come home for dinner, which is not a supposition that all wives of all players can make today.
That's very true. And they led a very nice life together, they and their son, Christy Jr. And although he was very much a public figure and he appeared in vaudeville and in silent movies and endorsed products and ran some business on the side, he still was not a somebody who'd go out and carouse with or without her in New York.
Mathewson played on New York Giants teams managed by John McGraw, and that had to be an intriguing mix of personalities. But I gather that Mathewson and the little Napoleon tolerated each other very successfully.
Well, more than tolerated. They were very close friends. In fact, when McGraw first came to the Giants, Mathewson was still basically a rookie. He threw well, but he didn't pitch well. And McGraw recognized what great talent there was there, and he took it upon himself to teach Mathewson to be a true pitcher. And probably fortunately for both of them, their wives also liked each other a lot. And in fact, in 1903, when they came back from spring training, the two couples decided to share an apartment in New York. So basically, there was a 24-hour baseball tutorial going on with McGraw working with Mathewson to understand the hitters in the league and to refine his pitching, particularly his control.
Also, McGraw obviously was not going to quarrel with his meal ticket with the greatest pitcher he'd ever seen.
Well, that's right, there was an interesting relationship between the two of them. Of course, McGraw was extremely fiery as a manager, and he'd fight with other teams, umpires, owners of other teams. He didn't really care. He'd get in a brawl at a moment's notice. But and he and Mathewson got along very well. There was one occasion when Mathewson loved to play golf, among other things, and McGraw didn't want him doing that, particularly on days that he was going to pitch. Mathewson would smuggle his golf clubs in the bottom of his footlocker to go on team trips. And once when he had to come in and pitch after playing 18 holes and wasn't up to his usual standard, McGraw bawled him out in front of the whole team, said, "Is it going to be golf or baseball?" And Mathewson just sort of smiled, paid his fine, and they went on.
Now, shortly after Christy Mathewson retired, he agreed to cover the 1919 World Series for the New York World, the newspaper. That must have been a strange and ultimately depressing experience for Mathewson, who cared so much about the integrity of the game.
Well, that's right, because he was able to see that things were not as they should be in those games. At first, he was willing to give the Chicago White Sox, later known as the Black Sox, the benefit of the doubt. But as he watched, particularly in the final game of the series, when the White Sox pitcher would throw nothing but fastballs and the Cincinnati batters quickly realized that and just teed off on him and won the series with that. He knew that was it was fixed, and he felt personally betrayed by that. In fact, just the year previous to that, he had tried to get baseball to clean up its act, tried to get baseball to act against Hal Chase, who was probably the most notorious gambler among the players, and baseball basically didn't do very much. And after it was very clear that the 1919 series had been fixed, Mathewson said to a friend, "I knew this was going to happen. They let Chase get away with it, and that just gave the green light to the other players who wanted to gamble. They didn't think anything would happen to him." So he felt that the game had been betrayed by those who were in charge of running it.
You write of Christy Mathewson that, quote, "he rose above the rowdy, loutish status quo and lifted baseball with him," and you compare him to Woodrow Wilson, not, I gather, just because they were contemporaries.
Well, I think Wilson brought a certain moralistic viewpoint to the presidency, and Mathewson did that with baseball as well. And not just baseball. Mathewson, for example, wrote a series of very popular books, novels for boys, about baseball. They were all cast around players on a particular team. But they also had a moral lesson to them. Mathewson was a great champion of pluck, which is a word we don't hear very often. But he really thought that baseball, if played correctly, could inculcate very good standards in young people particularly. And he saw the best of baseball as being reflective of the best of America.
Philip Sieb is the author of The Player, Christy Mathewson, Baseball and the American Century, published by Four Walls, Eight Windows. Mr. Sieb, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
And when someone had to stand up straight and get that ball across the plate, I'd swear, Maddie, I'd swear that God himself had sent his right-hand man to see us through. And it was you, Maddie. It was you.
Though it no longer seems likely, it's hard to deny that the best of all World Series matchups would feature the Chicago Cubs versus the Boston Red Sox. The Sox haven't won a championship since 1918. The Cubs have gone without series rings since 1908. Were the two seriously series-deprived teams to meet for all the potatoes, what would happen?
Game 7, bottom of the ninth. The Cubs are up 1-0. The Red Sox have the bases loaded with two outs and a 3-2 count on Nomar Garciaparra. Joe Browski pitching from the stretch, and Browski can't stay upright on the mound.
That's got to be a ball.
This wind, this sudden, I don't know what to call it.
A hurricane, a tornado, a typhoon. Oh,
swept Browski off the mound.
Ball.
He's tumbling head over heels across the field, and he disappears into the dugout. That had to hurt.
I don't think he's coming back out.
No, indeed. The bullpen gate is open, and I think we're going to see
a swarm of locusts.
Yeah, the pitcher is Todd Wellmeyer, who's only had one save all season. This is a surprise.
They're in my hair.
Wellmeyer's trying to get to the mound, and
the ground has opened up. It's swallowed Wellmeyer.
Looks like Dusty Baker has to make another call to the bullpen. So let's go down to Chet Marks with a lucky fan watching the game from the bleachers. Chet?
I have here, sorry, what's your name?
Death.
So, Mr. Death, are you a Sox fan or a Cubs fan?
I'll take them both.
And I see you're here with some friends. What are their names?
This is Pestilence, Famine, and
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
Hiya.
All right, then. You boys enjoy the game. This is Chet Marks pitching it back upstairs.
Nomar looks determined. A World Series ring is really all his resume lacks.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
What's that glow in the distance?
Please try to leave the park in orderly fashion.
Nomar is fiddling with his batting gloves like an octopus with a rash. Good God, that's annoying.
Up beyond the scoreboard. That glow in the east, coming this way. It's red and orange and angry.
Angry.
It's hail and the fire. It's fire!
Beware, Gate D. There be dragon in there. Gate D, block by three-headed dog. Try the charred gap, right field wall. Thank you. Coming to Fenway Park, Red Sox remind you, drive home safely.
The Cubs host the Braves this afternoon, and the A's will battle the Red Sox tonight at Fenway Park. Should the seventh seal be opened, the teams should fare well in their respective divisional series and beyond. You're listening to Only a Game. Last week, I commiserated with Detroit Free Press columnist Drew Sharp about the Tigers. The team seemed about to at least tie the record for most losses in a single baseball season. Mr. Sharp agreed that times had been hard and maintained that the Red Wings were his city's only hope. This prompted Joe McMahon, who hears Only a Game on WEOS in Geneva, New York, to write, "I thought Drew Sharp might want to know there were 19,000 people paying attention to a Detroit sports team besides the Red Wings recently. They thoroughly enjoyed cheering the shock onto the WNBA championship. As one fan told me, it was the most fun he'd had at a game ever." Jim Hansen, who hears the program on KUFM in Missoula, Montana, hailed us this week to say, "Congratulations to Only a Game. When I read the October 1st Wall Street Journal article about extreme ironing, I could only chuckle. I'd learned about extreme ironing from your show and felt smug knowing this was old news." David Ross of Columbus, Ohio, wrote of soccer dad W.D. Wetherill's commentary, which aired last week, "I wish every youth soccer parent could listen to his words." Among the other folks who wrote to express admiration for Mr. Wetherill's ability to bite his tongue in the face of triumph as well as adversity were George Mitchell and Chuck Kelly, as well as Greg Ulrich, who hears Only a Game on WFYI in Indianapolis, and Byron Wright of San Diego. Bob Stover, who heard last week's show on KJZZ in Phoenix, wrote to say, "You did a terrific job on the Jimmy O'Connell story. I'm glad you got to the bottom of the pile on your desk." Finally, we get a lot of inquiries regarding the music on the program, but Dave Levin of Murphy, North Carolina, is the first listener to ask about the music you've been hearing behind this letters segment. Dave, it's Shopping Spree by Laurie Johnson, anthologized on Scamp Records' Music for TV Dinners. Makes you hanker for some defrosted hash browns and indeterminate meat, doesn't it? I wonder why there aren't any radio dinners. Your questions and comments will reach us at Only a Game, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is oag@wbur.bu.edu. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. In yesterday's National League Divisional Series games, Pudge Rodriguez delivered the tying and winning runs in the 11th inning, lifting the Florida Marlins over the San Francisco Giants 4-2. The win gives the Fish a 2-1 lead in the best-of-five series. Game 4 is scheduled for this afternoon in Miami. In the other NLDS game, the Chicago Cubs defeated the Atlanta Braves by a score of 3-1. The Cubs now enjoy a 2-1 advantage in games and hope to close out the series this afternoon in Chicago. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a competition for men of iron which won't involve triathletes or even Ozzy Osbourne. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Tennis great Althea Gibson died on Sunday at the age of 76. One of the many attending a memorial service on Wednesday said, quote, "I came to say goodbye to an icon." An icon whom some folks may not remember as they should these days.
I just remember that when I first became aware of sports in the late 50s and early 60s, Althea Gibson was just one of those names that you knew about because she had done such remarkable stuff. She won 11 Grand Slam titles, including singles at the French Open and the U.S. Open in Wimbledon. She was the first black woman to compete in a major U.S. tennis championship, first black player to win Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. Opened the doors to Serena Williams and Venus Williams, to make the most obvious example, but also to Arthur Ashe. Althea Gibson was one of those people you knew about even if you didn't know the full scope of her performance. Of course, Bill, I may just be overrating her because she's African-American.
On last week's NFL Sunday Countdown, speaking of same, commentator Rush Limbaugh said the media had overpraised quarterback Donovan McNabb out of the desire to see a black quarterback do well. Those remarks precipitated Limbaugh's resignation from ESPN on Wednesday. Was this the best possible outcome for all involved?
First of all, Bill, I'd like to wish you and all of our listeners of Only a Game a happy National Schadenfreude Day. I would like to point out for the record and in praise of my sports writing colleagues that Rush Limbaugh has been a fat, truthless charlatan for 20 years on the subject of politics, and people in Washington still kiss his draft exemption like he actually knows something. He lasted less than a month talking about a sport that isn't populated by idiots and ditto heads, and God love him for blowing him out of there. Now, having said that, I don't think what he said was inherently racist. I think it was inherently ignorant. I think it was inherently uninformed. I think it was inherently the view of a man who's never been within 50 yards of a press box except for a free meal. Anybody who thinks there's a liberal conspiracy among sports writers to do anything has never been there. I've been in press boxes where I was the only liberal.
Before the resignation, McNabb said that although he had no quarrel with Limbaugh's assessment of his play in the Eagles' first two games, he expressed disappointment at what he considered racial remarks. They were, at least according to him, a claim that ESPN has denied. You're saying they were not inherently racist.
No, but I'd like to point out that Rush Limbaugh is a man who once told an African-American caller on his other radio program to, quote, take the bone out of your nose. So you sort of lose a bit of the edge off your argument that you're not a racist when you do that. I would also like to point out that Donovan McNabb showed more class in a 20-minute press conference than Rush Limbaugh has shown his entire public career.
In one of the more ironic statements I've heard in a while, McNabb said earlier this week that he wished for the furor to subside so that he could concentrate on the Eagles' next game, which is against the Redskins. Speaking of racist names and slurs built into the whole world of sports.
There you go.
Games will be played today in all four of Major League Baseball's divisional series. Charlie, in the American League, the Red Sox will fight for the right to party once more at Fenway, although they'll have to beat Oakland not only at Fenway and then at Oakland to be able to do that. The Yankees and Twins will try to break a 1-1 deadlock. What do you see coming out of the American League?
Well, right now, I think the Yankees and the Twins are still up in the air. The Yankees are a very tough out. They got a huge game from Andy Pettit in Game 2, and they're back in the series. The Red Sox, I fear to say, because they've done the opposite of everything I've said all year, the Red Sox look extremely done to me. I think the most significant moment of the series was in Game 1, which went till the ungodly hour of almost 3 in the morning, when Grady Little, for reasons that passeth understanding, used his Game 3 starter, Derek Lowe, to pitch in relief at the end of Game 1, thereby, I am fairly certain, losing the emotionally and kind of competitively fragile Lowe for Game 3. I think the Red Sox are in big trouble.
Tomorrow in Portland, the U.S. will play Germany, and the surprisingly successful Canadian team will take on Sweden in the Women's World Cup semifinals. Given the recent demise of the WUSA here, maybe organizers should consider reestablishing a women's pro league in Canada, or Germany, or Sweden.
Does that mean we have to give, like, Columbus to Canada?
I don't know. The details remain to be worked out by smarter people than me.
I think the most interesting thing about the tournament so far is that Canada was able to beat China. And apparently, as near as I can tell from all the women's soccer savants I know, namely you, the Canadians took a rather NHL approach to the game against China.
The NHL approach to the game has pervaded the tournament. There's been a great deal of physical play. I think that's one of the developments in women's soccer, that everybody's saying, hey, you know what, we've got to get these big kids up front and knock heads.
Well, then how did the women's league fail? I mean, it's taking a very American approach to the sport right now.
On Sunday, Ed Whitlock became the first man over 70 years old to run a marathon in under 3 hours. He was very self-deprecating about his achievement when it was all over.
He said it was a cheap version of Roger Bannister's 4-minute mile, and I give him big props for remembering Roger Bannister and using his name. But then he quite honestly said, I feel pretty awful right now.
An admission that most runners don't make.
I hope Ed's feeling better today. I really do, because it really is quite an accomplishment.
In Pinson, Alabama, last Saturday, Joseph Allen Logan was charged with attempted murder. And bear with me, this is allegedly a sports story of a sort. Mr. Logan had been watching the Alabama football team lose to Arkansas, and he felt compelled to put a gun to his 20-year-old son's head and pull the trigger. Happily, for all concerned, he missed. One suspects alcohol may have been involved in the adventure. What's the appropriate punishment? No more watching college football for you, sir?
Bill, you are a shrewd guy, because according to the police report, Mr. Logan had been drinking alcohol and began slamming doors, tossing boxes, and throwing dishes in the sink after the Crimson Tide lost to Alabama. This is not something we should play for laughs. The bullet just narrowly missed the 20-year-old son. And Joseph Allen Logan will certainly be watching his football games with 9 or 10 of his closest friends in the cell block.
In another college sports story, the University of Maryland has made cheerleading a varsity sport, and critics have immediately concluded that this is an attempt to sidestep Title IX. A valid charge?
I think it probably is. I think you're going to find a zillion creative ways now that they lost before the Let's Trim Title IX Back Commission, and they're probably going to continue to lose in the courts. It's not like the presidents of universities that engage in large-scale college sports aren't used to looking for loopholes in practically every law. This is just the latest example.
A recent poll by Atlanta's sports marketing group has established that dogfighting is the most hated sport in the United States, and pro wrestling came in second. Anything on this list surprise you, Charlie?
Well, bullfighting is number 3 and boxing is number 4. But further down the list at 5, 6, 7, and 8 are the PGA Tour, the Senior PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour, and then NASCAR. From this poll, I have to conclude that Americans hate every sport.
Charlie, your dream of buying the Montreal Expos and moving the team to Cuba has encountered some opposition. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico has written Bud Selig to tout Monterey as a great home for the Expos. Have you a counter-argument to make?
Yes. What is the U.S. ambassador doing pimping for a baseball team?
Hey, there's a great tradition of
baseball.
I mean,
is he working for the Monterey Chamber of Commerce at the same time? I'm outraged.
Right.
I mean, I have serious government forces arrayed against my plan now. And now that I'm clearly in the underdog role here.
You should relish it.
I know it, but still, I don't think the United States government should be working against my grand design.
Finally, Charlie, the Paris...
How's my tinfoil hat look, by the way?
Finally, Charlie, the Paris, Texas school district has apologized, as well it might, for a recent performance by one of its marching bands. Thank you for the music coming in, Mr. Producer. Would you care to offer a review of that short live Thank Goodness show?
Yeah, the high school band decided to do a program called Visions of World War II, and it included a Adolf Hitler anthem, not this one, and waved a Nazi flag, and this happened to happen on Rosh Hashanah. All concerned have apologized. All concerned need to go not only to sensitivity school, but back to History 101. And what more could I say except I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine and earns rave or raving reviews each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Free time for you.
For generations, Mohawk and other Native Americans have built the world's most famous buildings and bridges, including the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center. They work the high steel, a dangerous profession practiced hundreds and even thousands of feet above the ground. The skill and craft of ironworking took center stage last month near Syracuse, where ironworkers competed in events like knot tying, wrench throwing, and the 30-foot column climb. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
On a grassy field in Canastota, New York, men in union jackets and caps shake hands and pat backs like they're at a family reunion. Warren Connors and Tom Benz worked on a job at a high school together.
He used to be my boss. We haven't seen each other in
10, 15 years.
15 years, probably.
About 100 iron workers and their families are here from all over New York State to celebrate their trade and engage in a little friendly competition. A bigger international iron worker festival is hosted each year by Mackinac City, Michigan. But this one, put on by the nearby Oneida Indian Nation, has a different focus. It highlights the contributions of Native Americans to the country's buildings and bridges. The day starts with the traditional Iroquois Thanksgiving prayer in Mohawk. Then iron workers saunter across the field for the first event.
Number 30. What local?
440.
440.
At the spud throw, competitors try to hurl a wrench into a wooden target from 20 feet away. Mike Swamp runs the union office on the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation in northern New York.
Oh, good. It's called the erection wrench. It's iron workers carry that around to make their bolts, to make the holes in a beam. And what we do here is simulate that if they do drop it to the ground, the guys will pick it up and send it back up in the air.
1 minute to get off as many throws you can. When you're ready, let me know, and I'll tell you when to go.
Mike Swamp's son, Owen, grabs a handful of steel bolts for the bolt throw. He has 1 minute to toss them into a bucket hanging on 15 feet of scaffolding. He says iron workers do this on the job when someone above them drops a bolt.
Time.
Swamp sinks about a dozen. He says he started ironworking 5 years ago.
It's in our blood, I guess. I don't know. My father was an ironworker. My grandfather's, both my grandfathers were ironworkers. Part of our lives, you know.
According to Owen's father, almost 10% of the Akwesasne Mohawk tribe is a member of the union. The history of Mohawks on the high steel goes back to the 1880s. The French were building a bridge across the St. Lawrence River near Montreal. Mohawks on the job scrambled nimbly across steel beams hundreds of feet above the river, reportedly without fear. Marilyn John, a Bear Clan mother of the Oneida Nation and wife of a retired iron worker, says after the turn of the century, men followed steel shipments to job sites in New York and other cities.
You had to have a living. You would follow the red iron wherever the jobs were, on the railroad or on trucks. You would follow the red iron, and then you'd try to get a job wherever that iron would stop.
Their reputation grew, and soon Mohawks and other Native Americans were laying steel beams on the world's tallest buildings.
You don't know the back hitch?
All right, let me see what's color. Put a stopper hitch.
Peter Jacobs hunches over a couple ropes at the knot-tying event. While most other iron workers wear work clothes, Jacobs sports a white cowboy hat, crisp white shirt, and a proud demeanor. He says the iron worker's greatest asset is courage.
I ain't afraid of heights. You can put me in. No matter how high you want me, I'll go. 1,000 feet, 2,000, 3,000, I'll go. It doesn't bother me one bit. To me, it's a challenge. The higher I am, the better I am. I feel safer.
Jacob doubts Mohawks are any less fearful of heights than other people.
There's white guys out there just as good. There's Native Americans that are good all over the country. There's African Americans. There's Puerto Ricans. It's up to the individual themselves how good they want to be. You have it or you don't have it.
Whatever the background, Marilyn John adds it's important to honor iron workers because of the toll the job takes on them.
The profession does damage to you. Not everybody, but if you look around, there's a lot of guys limping with canes and all that kind of stuff because the first thing to go are the knees.
Because yeah. Why the knees? Because they're always sort of pulling up on
pulling up,
pulling,
yep.
Pulling themselves up.
And yep. And if you watch that column climb, that's what they use, their knees.
All day, a buzz surrounds the 30-foot column climb. When the event starts, a couple hundred people encircle a steel girder crowned with an American flag. One by one, men strap into a harness, scrape the dirt off the soles of their work boots, and scramble up.
Pull, pull, pull! Let's go! Pull, keep pulling, keep pulling! That's it, baby, you got it, baby! You got it!
Competitors ring a bell at the top and slide down. Some guys climb up in seconds like Spider-Man. Others slip and heave their way up.
Josh's time was 34.26.
Nice job.
The atmosphere is more supportive than competitive. Dick Odo, a hulk of a man with a baby face, says one old-timer got teary-eyed because it was the first time he'd received public recognition in a career spanning decades. Odo says while the events are fun, the honor and support are what matters in such a dangerous profession.
We all watch each other's back. A lot of tradition here. Million years of experience right here. Passed down from generation to generation. Ah, it's pride. That's all it is. It's just pride in the business. It feels good to be an ironworker.
For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein at the Ironworker Festival in Canastota, New York.
And we're ready.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah,
yeah.
Get up here, baby.
Yeah.
Come
on. Yeah.
Isn't she a beauty? Isn't she a queen? Nicest bridge that I have ever seen. Her paint's a little tattered where age has left its touch. Still, I guess I'll always love her very much. Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Special thanks to Only a Game's Armageddon players, Walter Dixon and George Hicks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out some photos of ironworkers working iron. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Swedish striker Victoria Svensson, who was asked for the key to her team's 2-1 victory over Brazil in their quarterfinal match on Wednesday.
We scored 2 goals and then one. That's the key.
More proof that a silly question sometimes nets a mathematically indisputable answer. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Not any old bridge, but the Brooklyn Bridge. I pity the New York crowd, the folks in Manhattan are sad, 'cause they look at her and wish they had the good old Brooklyn. Nothing but the Brooklyn, the good old Brooklyn Bridge.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.